This is an ABC podcast.
Hello once more, welcome to The Minefield. We try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life on this show. We have been more or less overcome with them. I was going to say recently. Recently could mean anything. It could do a lot of work, that word here, in this context, couldn't it? It could mean the last past couple of weeks. It could mean this year. How about the last 5 to 10 years? How about the last 50 years? Let's see what my co-host makes of that assertion. Scott Stevens is his name. Waleed Ali is mine. Hi, Scott. Where do you want to start here?
Well, I'm not sure about the 50-year mark. I mean, that could
That one, I just picked a number, let's be honest.
That could do some very, very nice work for us. It would probably take us well and truly beyond our allotted time slot. Yeah. But what do you say we begin with, or we confine ourselves at this stage, at least to the last 4 years? And I think it's probably fair to say that the last 4 years has thrown up our fair share of quite serious challenges, not just to the way that we think about our common life and the way that we think about the shared project that we call democracy, but I think it's fair to say that to this political order that we inhabit in the West, the predominant political order, democratic representative politics, has undergone a series of seismic shocks. These could, in fact, and I think it's probably best to think of them as shocks that are external to politics. They may well be referred to as sort of externalities, at least to representative politics. But there's certainly things that have happened outside of politics as we understand them, and that the effort of politics has then been to try to take account of them, to try to absorb them into its bloodstream, to try to give them, in some instances, I think maybe a kind of legislative or institutional effect, or in other ways, just to try to be adaptable to the shifting ground all around them. So if we named these four shocks, and I think they're very different, and it's interesting to work out to what extent have these four shocks changed the way that we think about what politics means and the way that we practice it. I would nominate these four shocks as the outcome of the Brexit referendum in 2016. I don't think really any controversy there. Then again, in 2016, the election of Donald Trump. I think it's interesting to think about both of those as things that begin outside of politics and impose themselves upon the political order as we understand it. And what we've been watching, I think, in a very real way ever since is how representative or parliamentary or, representative or parliamentary politics have tried to take into account, have tried to adapt themselves to that changing political landscape.
I fear I don't accept that categorization quite.
Well,
go on.
Go on. Tell me why, because I think I can argue convincingly against it.
Okay. Well, in what sense are they external? The forces that were at play in the Brexit referendum were, it seems to me, at least from a distance, and we have a guest that I think can rule on this far more authoritatively than either of us, but it seemed to me to have been in train from within the mechanics of parliamentary politics for a long time. The whole Brexit referendum was an attempt to end or at least create a ceasefire within a civil war within the Tory party. You had other parties and other forces within parliamentary politics, or some who weren't successfully in parliamentary politics, but it tried to be, who'd been running with the issue of Brexit for a very long time. It was the culmination of a whole series of forces and mechanics and steps and perhaps even missteps that were endemic and inherent to the process of parliamentary politics. And as for Trump, I mean, I fear the specter of repetition looking over my shoulder here, because we've spoken about this a lot, but Trump really becomes symptomatic of a whole lot of changes in American society, yes, but a whole lot of movements that had been, let's say, energized by people within congressional politics and even perhaps presidential politics in America for quite a long time. You can't tell the story of Trump without telling a story about the Republican Party itself. So I think it depends what you mean by external, because these things aren't external to those systems.
No, I accept that. I think especially in the instance of Brexit, I think what's interesting there is that the final decision was thrown to the people in order to give a degree of cover to the politicians who wanted a, I think you're right, a final ruling one way or the other about the issue of Britain's membership to the EU. But I think what's interesting is that once it was thrown back to the people, that act of throwing back then commingled, if you like, with a pervasive sense both of, I think, political despair. I think it's probably worth calling it a degree of despair about the unrepresentative nature of politics and the degree to which politics simply didn't touch. It didn't seem to give, it didn't seem to register what was actually being felt or actually being being experienced in the lives of, and I think here it's important to probably say the English people. So as soon as the decision is being thrown back to the people, there is something that goes then outside of the parliamentary system that once it's then given back to Parliament to know what to do with, to give that a degree of legislative effect, there's really no clear way to, in fact, do that. Once it's being handed back, I think it becomes something utterly different. It becomes maybe a democratic decision, but it's not easily absorbed back into representative politics.
Okay. I think I know where you're going. I'm still not sure I entirely agree. Okay. But also, there are more timely examples you want to get to, so let's not be detained.
Well, yes. And I think, just in the instance of Trump, I think the very fact that Trump himself and everything that he stands for found such little purchase within the institution of the GOP. And it was fundamentally discordant, I think, with many of the leading figures within the GOP in 2016. I think, again, you can say that there is a moment of, there is a sense of, if you like, popular sentiment. There is maybe even something democratic in the sense that there's a degree of non-representativeness that's trying to be channeled through Trump here that, again, doesn't map easily, I think, onto the GOP the way that it understood itself in 2016. I think that's changed. You're absolutely right. It's changed since then. But that process of change has been very, very, very difficult, I think quite traumatic for the GOP. What's more interesting to me are the two most recent shocks, the shocks that we've seen this year. I think one is the COVID-19 pandemic. This really has disrupted democratic politics. It's led to a massive expansion, I think, in the reach and the nature of state power. The states like the US, the UK, Australia, across Europe, federal governments have done things that I think are quite extraordinary, remarkable, almost unprecedented in our time, both in closing down an economy, but also effectively confining people to home, you know, essentially reasserting who has or what has ultimate power in a time like ours. And yet at the same time, that's meant that these states have to incur enormous and again, almost unprecedented levels of debt in response to this economic shock. And then we've seen after that, another kind of pandemic, and that's the pandemic of institutionalized, authorized police violence against black bodies, which has then given rise to this enormous uprising, this series of mass demonstrations across the United States and again here in Australia, in the UK, across Europe. There's a different kind of political mobilization there. But I think what's interesting about these last two, Waleed, is that both of these shocks have meant that things that were previously quite simply off the table, that were inconceivable within the accepted political orders, are suddenly back on the table. Governments doing things that were almost unheard of even earlier this year. The very fact that we're talking quite seriously about defunding or even abolishing the police, the fact that that's a conversation, that's a serious conversation being held in an election year, I think that tells you something about the way in which politics is being forced to change to try to adapt itself to these seismic shocks. And yet here's the paradox. Our politics, it seems to me, has never looked more conventional than it does at this moment. With the Labour leadership race in the UK, there was quite a diverse, in terms of certainly in terms of gender and age, field in the Democratic primaries in the US for the presidency. Again, there was a historically diverse, both in terms of age and race and gender, field, and yet what are we left with? We're left with a middle-aged white Labour leader in the UK, in Keir Starmer. We are left with an old white centrist in Joe Biden in the US. There's something very strange happening here with the kind of seismic shocks that are being thrown up, and yet the reassertion, if you like, of a kind of conventionality of Western politics. That leads, I think that throws up a kind of paradox, a contradiction that it's worth us trying to tease out.
It's interesting. I wonder whether it's overstated, though. I mean, partly that stems from my original disagreement with the first two shocks as being external that you identify. But, I mean, if you take the idea of defunding police, or at least kind of trying to reconfigure them in another form, that has happened before in the United States, right? There were other, there were parts, I think there was one in California. Was there one elsewhere? I remember a couple of examples that where this had happened previously before you saw a similar move made, this time in Minnesota. Now, it's possible that the conversation has a bit more heat in it this time and that there are more places around the country that are considering this kind of action. And certainly, it is certainly true that if you are to take stock in opinion polls, support for the Black Lives Matter movement and the basic the tenets of that movement insists upon is growing at a rapid rate and has really taken off since those protests arrived. So that much is true. We're not necessarily looking at conversations or actions that have been unprecedented wholly. What we might be seeing is their development more than their sudden arrival. And the COVID thing, I think, is an interesting example because it's such an exception to so many rules. And here, I think it very much depends on where in the world you are observing this and having this conversation. Because in Australia, I would observe that actually politics and political debate and government action has reverted to type incredibly quickly. Am I surprised? I'm going to go with surprised for the moment. I'm surprised.
But the way we've snapped back effectively.
Yeah, at how quickly normal service has resumed. Partly that is surely a consequence of the fact that we've had a very mild pandemic by global standards, at least so far, that even the economic pain has been less than was anticipated. There are extraordinary policies on the table, but really you have a government now, certainly at the federal level, whose ambition seems to be to figure out how we can get away from those extraordinary policies as quickly as possible and return to something like we had. So, yes, I see the contradiction you're scratching at. I worry that it's overstated. By the way, that doesn't get in the way of me enjoying a conversation about this contradiction because I love nothing more than a theoretical contradiction. But I do, I'm going to put those caveats out there and then we'll see to what extent they become relevant as the conversation proceeds.
Fair enough.
Is that fair?
Sounds good.
All right. This is The Mindfield. You can listen to the show on RN, on the radio, in the old-fashioned way, which you might be doing right now. But you can also catch us anytime on the ABC Listen app. And you can subscribe to our podcast wherever it is that you do such things. I would heartily recommend it because we keep going past the final siren when we do that. And so we just keep going on with our guest. And if ever you would want to do that, I would have thought today's guest is a very good place to start.
This is very, very exciting. We've been trying for this for a while. David Runciman is professor of politics at Cambridge University. David, both Waleed and I have followed your work forever. He's also the host of Talking Politics. And just to show you, David, that my love, in fact, is true, he's the author of two terrific books, several books, most recently How Democracy Ends and Where Power Stops. But one of my favorite books is his 2008 book, Political Hypocrisy, which I think is one of those little masterpieces in political theory. David, thank you so much for coming back on The Mindfield.
It's a pleasure.
So look, let's get you to give us a read of where you think we are right now. In some ways, it does feel like something new, something very, very different is happening in representative politics. At the same time, it feels like something very conventional, very normal is happening in representative politics. And I think one of the clearest examples for me is the fact that in the UK, British Parliament was effectively paralyzed, if you like, for the better part of 3.5 years. And then a very old-fashioned general election happened, and a very old-fashioned parliamentary majority was handed to the Tories, and now everything seems to have gone back to normal. There's very strange things that are happening here, and we're hoping you can set us straight.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, the British general election in December was one of those events where we thought we were in this crazy alternative universe, and it took about 5 minutes of the exit poll just to snap back. But I don't want to mess too much with your time frame, but I think it's also true, you know, there are other shocks. And in the UK, actually, the most surprising thing of all in recent years was the election of Jeremy Corbyn to be leader of the Labour Party. That came from nowhere. Brexit was unlikely. Corbyn, before it happened, seemed impossible. And it was a reflection of a deep frustration. I do take your view on this with conventional representative politics. It was really pushing back, and it was trying to argue for what I think now tends to be called movement politics. And we've seen different manifestations of this, Macron. There are strong echoes of it in what's going on in the United States at the moment, and then the Bernie campaign. So there is something, I think, bigger than just representative democracy accommodating these new forces. So that's part of what's going on. But then these events like the British general election kind of snap you back, because you realize that movement politics, this was Corbyn's problem, you can't do it really through the conventional channels. I mean, in a sense, you have to go further. And the one other thing I would say is that COVID particularly, and certainly seen in the UK, what it reminds me of is the other great crisis, which is 2008, the financial crisis, the global financial crisis. Well, what I think we saw were two things that we're seeing now. One is this frustration with representative democracy and this sense that people want at least to find other outlets. And the other is, in a real crisis, the assertion of the power of the state. Those extraordinary things that you said that the state is doing now in Britain and the US, they were the things, the extraordinary things that had to be done in 2008, 2009, that in a sense we both want more from our politics, and we keep being reminded we are at the mercy of our politics regardless of who we elect. And I think representative democracy is being squeezed between those two things, a kind of brute fact about politics, which is state power is still state power, and this sense that people want something more.
The idea of movement politics I find very attractive, but I wonder if the thing that is interesting about it is that it is precisely that it reveals the limits of state power, particularly the discursive limits of state power. So as people abandon the sort of traditional structures of power, you know, party membership, for example, branches. This is a very live conversation in Australia right now, this week, as it happens, because of a branch stacking scandal that we're currently witnessing. But as that declines and people sign up to movements, but we live in an environment, an informational context, particularly through social media and the internet, where, you know, all of our attachments to movements becomes incredibly fractured and diverse, but also much more aggressive, much more energetic and animated. All of those systems, it seems to me, mean that the state ceases to be the center of political life in quite the way that it was, certainly in the absence of a pandemic, and sometimes even in the presence of a pandemic. And what we're witnessing then is not so much the contradiction between politics going on as though nothing's happened, but rather the incapacity of politics to enter into a conversation with this kind of new movement politics that has a completely different communicative grammar, a different informational grammar, even a different plan of action as far as it's concerned. Like, the, you know, its mode of operation just doesn't map neatly onto anything that conventional politics can offer.
Yeah, I think that disconnect is definitely there, and we've seen it more and more in recent years. I think there's always a temptation. I mean, I do have a slight tendency also to see things as paradoxical. I think there is a temptation in movement politics to think that the movement can kind of take you round the state, can take you round conventional politics outside, and you can almost sort of reconfigure on the other side in the new space, which will be the new politics. And yet what we've seen in the last 10 years plus is that going round conventional politics does not make it go away. In some ways, it leaves it more unaccountable. It leaves it more open simply to raw exercises of power. And then we've had these moments when we've also realized we're dependent on those raw exercises of power. So these two things are going on at the same time. And I think there are temptations both ways, both for the believers in state power to think that they can crush movement politics, but that the movements think that they can get around it and outside it, and they can't. And we're right at the heart of that at the moment. The two things are going on at the same time. And social media, it does exaggerate the disconnect, but it doesn't break it. It's not like there's no connection. We're living through that at this moment. It's an extraordinary political moment. I do think that. I do think it's exceptional, an exceptional time.
This, I think, highlights one of the real problems with movement politics, and that's the moral absolutism that often attends to it. I mean, that was one of Jeremy Corbyn's great problems. And if representative politics has anything morally speaking going for it, it's the very fact that it can broker certain compromises and do it not just grudgingly, but almost as a kind of expression of its inner vocation. I kind of wonder, David, you know, there was this rule of thumb that was articulated by, I think, one of Australia's great political philosophers, an Indigenous thinker named Noel Pearson, that some of the great changes that take place in this country, especially when it comes to Indigenous recognition, can really only be accomplished by conservative politicians. You actually need a centrist or you need a conservative in order to usher in radical political change that goes to the heart of a nation's identity. I'm kind of thinking, you know, maybe someone like Joe Biden, given the moral absolutist nature of so much movement politics, maybe someone like Joe Biden is exactly what's needed in order to broker that kind of compromise with, say, the movement for Black Lives, in order to sort of put a hand, if you like, on the question of police abolition, to acknowledge the moral pain, to acknowledge the historical grievance that feeds that, but at the same time, kind of giving that a sort of articulation in a registry of representative politics that makes sense to enough people.
Yeah, I do think that, I mean, the moral absolutism is a big problem for representative politics for the reasons you say. It's designed to break it up. So you channel moral absolutism through representative systems and it doesn't work. So that does point to where you're suggesting we go, which is that what you have to have is politicians or forms of conventional politics that can absorb it. I do think there's a particular problem with Joe Biden, but it might be a wider problem. I mean, if you think of, so Franklin Roosevelt is a great example of a pretty conventional politician who, in circumstances more severe than the ones that we're living through now, managed to absorb forms of moral absolutism coming from the left, but also just social anger into transformative politics. But Biden, not just because of his age, but I think because of the moment that we're in, everyone sees him as a bridge to something. It's not him. Mm. I mean, with Biden, there's this feeling, I've heard people say it all the time, just get the guy elected. It doesn't matter. Get him elected. And then on day two of his presidency, we can get beyond Biden, even to the point of, like, you know, the vice president then can start thinking about, you know, when he has to step down. There is that sort of bridge to the future. People talk about Keir Starmer in these terms. Get the guy in, the conventional guy, the boring guy, the guy in the suit. And then the movement can kind of get to that next step. I think there aren't historical parallels for that. I think this is, I'm not sure it's dangerous, and, you know, in some ways it could have all sorts of possibilities in it, but it's not easy to see how, if you're Biden, you can both be the person who can absorb this stuff and the person that everyone is waiting to leave the stage so the real stuff can start. And I think that's our politics at the moment. People wanted someone like Corbyn because he makes sense. Like, he is moral absolutism, so he'll deliver, but he can't. That's our challenge.
Right, but let's assume the plan comes off and Biden wins.
Well, Biden steps down on day two.
Yes, and then vacates. Surely what follows from that is...
I think that's called a conspiracy.
Right. But let's assume it happens, right? Let's just play with me here. If that happens, isn't what follows then just further disillusionment with the structures of democratic politics on the basis that the whole thing's a lie, it's a scam, we've basically been tricked into this scenario where the guy we voted for suddenly disappears? Australian politics went through something very similar for about a decade.
Yeah, and it's true. If Biden wins, he'll have been elected by people who don't want him to step down and be replaced by AOC or whoever. They want to be governed by him because they want a centrist politician. I mean, it's true that when centrists are betrayed, it doesn't kind of present in quite the same way as when moral absolutists are betrayed. But still, yeah, these are the absolute dilemmas of the politics of our time. But it's also true, I mean, I think history does teach us these kinds of lessons, that on the whole, it is the case that the transformative presidents and leaders didn't look like the people who were billed in those terms before they arrived. I mean, whether it's Lincoln, Roosevelt, Reagan in the US, you know, Attlee in Britain, it is often conventional politicians who do it. But I do think in 2020, the strains on representative politics, both from pure state power and from the movements, is greater than in the past.
Mm. It's very well expressed, and there's a lot to tease out, which we'll do in the podcast part of the show, which is about to happen right now. So join us if you can. David Runciman is our guest from Cambridge University. We'll see you next week on The Minefield.
All right. Well, this is fascinating, David. So let's try to pick up one of the issues that you flagged before that we just didn't get anywhere near discussing closely enough. So the expansion of state power that we're seeing at the moment, the state, I think more so in Australia and the UK than in the US, filling the space that has been created by the pausing, by the temporary cessation of the economy. This is something that I think you're right. Most people wanted, in fact, to see, as much as they might decry or bemoan state overreach or even inefficiency in the distribution of federal or state funds. This is something that I think most people have wanted to see, the state becoming, if you like, the employer of last resort, the guarantor of not just public debt, but also of private debt. I'm just wondering, though, what this then means when things are having to, if you like, get back to normal. How does the state continue to broker that relationship with the people? I mean, here in Australia, we're seeing even now any relaxation of what's called here the JobKeeper scheme, where employers are being paid to keep their employees on the books. Any relaxation of that prematurely is being met with a surprising degree, I think, of nervousness, even of political anger. There's a huge kind of amount of kind of bank of faith that's been built up over the last few months. How does the state then negotiate this particular period of the return to something like normal once it's flexed its political muscle in this way?
Yeah, I do think the comparisons with the financial crisis are interesting here, because then, of course, the state was stepping in to take on these enormous obligations. But most people, most regular people, didn't feel it themselves, because it was essentially banks and massively indebted businesses that were being rescued. This time it's jobs. So it's very different. And the unwinding of it this time will be felt by people every day. And we all know people who are worried whether they'll have a job in a few months' time. We know businesses that can't function. That unwinding is going to be a much, I think, more acute kind of politics. It's also true, and this is the parallel with 2008, that people do get to see, certainly it's been true in the UK, it doesn't sort of matter which party is in power at a moment of absolute crisis, just as the Republicans in the end had to bail out, you know, go against all their principles in 2008 and bail out banks and failing businesses. A conservative government is having to essentially subsidize the wages of the entire nation, things that people said if Corbyn had done it, people would have, you know, expressed horror. So there's a kind of collapsing of the party distinction. So there are two challenges for these politicians, one of which is to remind people that those party distinctions still matter, but they've seemed meaningless recently. And secondly, to unwind these schemes, which is going to cause a huge amount of pain, and there will be winners and losers. And those winners and losers are going to shape politics for the next decade or more. So if nothing else, it's a monumental political challenge, I think, to get back to not politics as normal, but party politics, party divisions under these conditions. It is harder than 2008, I would say.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think about the Australian context there, because we've started to see it. Scott, wouldn't you say? You started to see these divisions. What is interesting, and I think chimes with what David is saying, is that it has no purchase. Like, I would even argue, maybe I'd need more data to make this point convincingly. I think the data is there. For all the fire and the fury around the Australian iteration of Black Lives Matter and the arguments we're all having now about sacred Indigenous sites being destroyed by mining companies, or statues being pulled down, or applications to pull memorials down, whatever it is. For all of that stuff, for all of the misspeaking that the Prime Minister did by asserting that Australia had a history that was free of slavery, for example, none of it seems to have any meaningful effect on the esteem in which the government is held and the esteem in which politics generally is held right now. which I think says something about just how profoundly unifying, in a sense, the moment of COVID has been, that even scandal cannot and does not disrupt it. You could look at Victoria right now, where the Victorian government is in a crisis, having lost three cabinet ministers because of the branch stacking scandal I noted earlier. And yet I suspect, without being able to say for sure, that if you did a if you got some good polling on the esteem with which that government is held right now and that Premier Daniel Andrews himself is held right now, it would be through the roof. It does seem a moment where nothing quite matters.
Well, it's a moment where politics hasn't yet reasserted itself beyond its fundamental role, which is to keep citizens safe.
No, but more than that, it's not subject to the other kind of politics of the moment, which is the movement politics we're seeing. Very different story, I suspect, for Donald Trump. But in Australia, not at all. It might be different in the UK too. I'd be interested in David's thoughts on it. But it's like, yeah, politics, conventional politics is in a parallel universe now to the kind of movement politics we've been talking about.
I mean, the UK is so unusual in this because the first of the shocks that you talked about, Brexit. So the general election that we had resolved the paralysis. Do we or don't we? Can we or can't we? Should we or shouldn't we? Well, we've done. We have. We're out. But it didn't resolve anything about what that means going forward. And in British politics, there is a fight going on right now. I mean, it has to be resolved this month about whether we extend the negotiations about the future trade arrangement with the European Union. And there is a lot of evidence that all of the energy, all of the passion that drove Brexit and then drove Johnson's election, got him elected with his big parliamentary majority, has also been dissipated by COVID. So the people who elected him in northern seats in England, traditional Labour seats that flipped Tory, and they did it for Brexit, no other reason really than Brexit. Get Brexit done was the slogan. And if they're asked now, what do you feel about Brexit? They say it doesn't matter. What matters is the government's job is to keep us safe. And safe here means both jobs and health, particularly healthcare systems. That's what it means. And any mucking around with the European Union in this context and that makes us unsafer will be unforgivable. Now, at some point, that is going to reassert itself in British politics. It's a difficult one for the Labour Party because the Labour Party has got a complicated relationship with Brexit. But still, now, in Britain, that's not going to go away for much longer. And when that comes back, it won't be politics as usual. There will be echoes of that earlier movement politics. But it will be, you know, really hard because COVID has... Johnson's not particularly popular at the moment because we have our own issues and our own scandals. And the British government has not been competent. But at some point, what residue of goodwill there is for Johnson around COVID will run up against the reason Johnson got elected, which was Brexit. And that clash could destroy this government, no question.
I think in the US, the case is really interesting. I mean, it's quite distinct from either of the cases that we're talking about, Australia or the UK, because I guess from the beginning, the COVID-19 pandemic has been politicized. It's actually been part of the partisan divide in that country. And maybe in the early stages, it was simply about the issue of federal competence, the simple ability administratively to handle something like a health crisis. But I think ever since, the very fact of not just incompetence, but also a kind of bumbling, relentless electioneering, the constant reduction of anything involving the national life to a person's personal approval rating or his own narcissistic vainglory. I mean, the very fact that this has always been brought back into Trump's own biography, I think that's also, if you like, poured fuel on the fire. I guess one of the things, though, that really strikes me, just going back for a moment to movement politics, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about the difference between, say, Black Lives Matter after 2014 and Black Lives Matter now. One of the big differences is the moral seriousness and the organizational sophistication of that movement in the 6 years that have intervened. I think that's a huge, huge, huge issue. This isn't just a spontaneous moment of democratic eruption that we're seeing on the streets. But I think it's also quite obviously, I think self-evidently the case that the movement would not have the ferocity and it simply wouldn't have the purchase at the moment had this been taking place under any other presidency. I think there's something about not just the incompetence of Donald Trump, but I think there's also something about the way in which he has willfully inflamed at the very moment when I think any other person in that role would try to conciliate, that has given this a degree of heat, and I think ultimately probably democratic effectiveness. So I'm just wondering, this is movement politics, yes. It's impinging itself on representative politics because it's taking place in an election year. But I think in some ways, quite beyond, you know, simply beyond Joe Biden, there is the likelihood of a kind of political effectiveness to this movement simply because of the circumstances in which it's being expressed.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, I think 6 years is a long time in movement politics. It's a long time in organization. It's a long time in technology. I mean, we're in a different world. But also the last 6 years have seen successes of movement politics. I mean, not on the whole, people getting elected. And the one who has, Macron, is not most people in other movements' idea of what they want. But the other thing to say is that Trump is not himself. You know, he is a one-man movement, but he ran against the establishment of both parties. You know, he ran against his own party in winning the presidency. He's an insider outsider, but he, you know, he comes at this from the outside, and he's given a hint of what's possible. I mean, he also has opened up the space for the possibility of radical disruption because he is so radically disruptive, and that is both deeply alienating for anyone who sees the world differently from Trump, but it's also galvanizing. I mean, Trump creates a sense of possibility in American politics, the idea that things that seemed impossible, and his presidency still, to me, in my mind, I still can't wrap my head around the fact we live in a world where this has happened. It's both impossible and it's happened. And that is galvanizing, no question. It's something to fight against, but it's also something, it gives a sense of just how open the space might be. And I do think that that's made a huge difference, and not even just in the United States. Mm. I mean, a world that contains Donald Trump, Donald J. Trump, as president of the United States, is a world in which just about anything is possible. And that means something, for good and for ill.
Yeah, it's kind of like, he's movement politics in the White House, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. And all of those paradoxes and contradictions, and also, frankly, pretty cast iron evidence that it doesn't work. It's not least because it's you know, you try and channel it through the existing institutions. I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders as president, lots of reasons to either want or not want that to have happened as an academic political scientist. I regret that we don't get that fantastic experiment to see, you know, what it's like. But I read his...
You've had your fun over the past 4 years, let's be honest. I mean, you've had...
I know, we have. It's the gift keeps on giving. But no Bernie yet, unless, you know, there's a long way to go to November. But you know, his platform said, you know, had all these, you know, some radical, some not, some by European standards, very conventional social democratic proposals. But the last one was, we have to reform the American electoral system, both the role of money, but the way it's set up, the gerrymandering, all of that, you know, all of it, the structures, basically the constitution of our country needs to change. And it says in that document, this is the hardest one of all, but without this, we may not be able to do the other things. That's the challenge, because, I mean, it's almost like saying it's so hard that maybe we won't get to that, but frankly, you know, get Bernie elected as president under this system, it's still, like with Trump, really hard to see how you get things done. It may be that you do need a Biden. I mean, it genuinely may be that you do need someone who knows how to, you know, pull the levers. But even then, under current conditions, you know, Obama, actually, he did some things, but it was incredibly tough. And we've been on this road to executive power in the United States through 3-4 presidencies, right back to Bill Clinton. Really hard to pass legislation. So divided, so partisan, so gerrymandered, so much money, so much lobbying, so little compromise. So presidents assert their authority more and more, and you get Trump. Now, these things are structural. They're not just about the people.
That's clearly true, although I wonder if maybe, and this seems a crazy thing to say given it's the most powerful country in the world, but I wonder if America needs to be factored out of this kind of reckoning, because it's such a singular case in the way that its politics has evolved, I would argue. Like, the Barack Obama experience, I think, was fascinating in that way, because you say it was incredibly tough for him to achieve. Look at his fight on healthcare, for example. Yes. But that's partly because he runs into a Republican Party that seems kind of historically incorrigible, if you know what I mean. The, the determined lack of cooperation. There was, of course, that famous, or should I say infamous, meeting of Republican power brokers the day that he's sworn in, or the day after he's sworn in, where they say, we're basically going to try to block everything that he wants to do, and they proceed to enact that strategy. And Obama comes to the office saying, I'm reaching across the aisle. He has a mixed cabinet, for example, and then very quickly discovers that that leads him nowhere. I do feel that while other countries have caught a bit of that disease, it's not a pandemic, let me put it that way. There are milder forms of that disease, and the American version of it is particularly deadly.
Yeah, I think, and when people say democracy this, democracy that, in the current state of the world, there are 100 different stories going on about democracy in different places. That it's not a pandemic. And I don't think it's just that there is this story, this kind of arc that runs from Bolsonaro through Trump, through Orban, Erdogan, Modi, you know, that is going on. But there are other equally interesting things going on. I mean, on our podcast, we spend a lot of time talking about Italy. Italy is a, you know, an important country in Europe with a, you know, it's not often had a super functional politics, but a nation like Italy trying to grapple with the challenges it faces through its representative institutions is finding it really hard. Frankly, actually, Macron is finding it hard. German politics does not look stable at the moment. I mean, Australia and New Zealand look pretty good. Canada looks pretty good. Scandinavia always looks okay. But it's weird that those are more like the exceptions than the rule now. So it's not a pandemic, and there are lots of different ways this could go. And I do agree, America under Trump is something else. But there is something going on, to go back to sort of where we started, that the pressure and the frustration that people feel with conventional party-based, election-based, mass media, newspaper media-based democratic politics, what I think of as 1990s politics. At the same time, and we haven't even mentioned climate, we live in a world where the power of the state has never been more important, for good or for ill. That is really squeezing these institutions, and these institutions are really struggling to cope, I think.
The other thing we haven't mentioned is the advent of global terrorism, which seemed to preoccupy us for so long, past decade. But I think of it as an interesting example to contemplate as well, because that was another thing that I think revealed the shallowness, as I would put it, of the state's claims to power. I mean, one of the problems that you had in trying to confront global terrorism was that the state could only reach for its conventional tools of power that meant nothing when they were applied to a problem that Zygmunt Bauman would have called liquid, you just don't obey those rules. And I wonder if that's an analogy. Maybe we're just looking at a liquid modernity here. Maybe that's a way of trying to encapsulate this, that it's the attempt of solid modernity rules of these sort of parliamentary institutions to try to grapple with and then accommodate these things that just evaporate, right? That constantly shift around. And maybe that's the real problem, Scott, that you're trying to identify here with the meeting of conventional and movement politics, is that we're all fed up with conventional politics. We can't stand it. But no one can stand movement politics either, except the people who are in the particular movement. And then that's not a basis for any kind of meeting point for a polity or even for a society.
No, I think that's exactly right. And if there's any way of squaring this particular circle, it seems to me it has to be that the final endpoint of movement politics has to be some kind of translation into political representation. I mean, okay, taking Macron as maybe not exactly the best example of this, although again, there's a particular kind of cult of personality happening there, and a degree of vainglory of a very, very peculiar French variety, and a kind of, you know, sneering disdain as well for a good deal of his own electorate. So, you know, there are sort of peculiar examples there, but I don't see, and again, this is where I think the movement for Black Lives is really, really impressive. There is a self-articulated, self-conscious understanding that the way in which this is given legislative effect, the way in which this becomes permanent, I think this is an issue for Indigenous Australians as well, is for it to be absorbed into, or for it at least to be registered in conventional representative politics. That has to be the end point here.
My sense of it, and it has been for a while, is that we have this underlying fear, and I'll sort of talk about you know, the possibility of a return of fascism or the collapse of representative institutions reflects this, that democracy, representative democracy has served us really well and it's under threat and we need to hold on to it and we need to absorb what's going on in the world into these institutions, because otherwise these institutions will break. And so that simultaneously we rely on these institutions, but that they are potentially quite fragile. And the result is that we really don't experiment with these institutions, so that, you know, we're living in this not just liquid world, but massively fast-moving experimental world in which, you know, in communication, in work, in business, in finance, there are people trying to do new things every day, for high stakes as well. And in politics, we're incredibly risk averse with our institutions. That's my feeling anyway, that we, that there's this feeling that if you tinker with them, if you introduce new ways of, you know, a referendum was a step too far for most people. If you introduce new ways of doing democracy, if you open it up, if you challenge conventional forms of representation, the system is going to break. And my fear for a while has been the alternative is that we cling on to this system past the point where it can absorb. And actually, there are 100 ways of doing democracy, of which 1990s representative democracy is just one. It's pretty good. And it worked pretty well for people of my age and my kind of privileged life. But it's not the only one, and it's not doing great at the moment. But it doesn't mean the alternative is fascism or authoritarianism. The alternative might be to try and do not 100 different things, but 6, maybe around the edges, maybe somewhere near the middle, randomize it, open it up, introduce forms of deliberation. I advocated lowering the voting age to 6, like let all children vote. Because I don't think it would do much harm, and I think it would, you know, lots of positive. And people react with horror to this. You know, you're like, you're playing with fire. No, you're not. Electing Donald Trump is playing with fire. Letting children vote is not playing with fire. And it's that mindset, I think, which is actually quite dangerous. The thought that we stick with this representative system and let it absorb everything it can and see where it takes us. And we might be fine. I have no idea. But we don't tinker with it. I think we should tinker with it. I mean, like Bernie, I think he changed the American Constitution. For God's sake, it's old.
You say that like it's an easy thing to do.
Yeah, I know. There are practical issues, but there are also mindset issues.
I don't know what you're complaining about. You got your big experiment in America. Just be satisfied with it. You've got plenty to work with there.
All right.
David, we are out of time. It's been a joy. The joy that we anticipated, I think we can say, to have you on the show. So appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
David Runciman is Professor of Politics in the Department of Politics and International Studies at Cambridge University, our guest for this week's edition of The Mindfield. I just thought I'd give him his full title on the way out there, Scott.
Yes, and if one episode of Mindfield a week is never quite enough for you, we are headlining Sunday's special day of RN's Big Weekend of Books. Waleed and I are going to be in conversation with the moral philosopher Susan Neiman about the nature of historical injustice and how to pay our past debts. You can listen to us at 10 a.m. on Sunday morning on RN. You'll be very glad you did.
See you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.